morning.
Well, before I get this thing on, and I think that Russ actually records off of this thing, so this will work. First of all, you probably notice I got a big blue thing on my finger. And what happened there was that I was trying to fix something that got broke in the storm. And the thing I was trying to fix chopped the end of my finger off. So I apologize ahead of time. The time last night, the 3 or 4 hours that I ordinarily would have spent trying to shrink this down and make it a little shorter, I spent in the emergency room last night waiting for them to sew me back up. See if this works. And it does. Okay. So sorry about that. And then the other note I guess I'd make is that the sermon was a request from my wife, and she said she heard somebody say something not too long ago, and she said, well, why don't you preach on the opposite of that? And I guess we'll see if I succeed on that or not, honey. In the beginning, from Brian McGee. Okay, I ate lunch with Brian this week, and his friends were talking about things they had from their childhood. And I said, hey, I know something like that I've got from my childhood. Maybe I'll share it. So we'll see how it goes. And I guess the message is, if you like the sermon, you're welcome. And if you don't, see Sharon or Brian. Okay, does this work?
Yeah.
Well, first thing, kids, come on up front. I got somebody to show you. I got somebody for you to meet. So come on up front. To look this way, you'll get to see it. So, this is my buddy. I named him a long time ago. His name is Teddy. That is Teddy Bear. So I thought it was a real cool name when I came up with it. Now, when I was a kid, and I think I was maybe 4 or 5, my folks gave Teddy to me. And he is something that I have had for a long time. So Teddy's 50-something years old. I don't know how old he is. As you can see now, he's blind and he doesn't hear nearly as well. He used to be a really good listener, and he was something that I kind of treasure from my childhood. Okay, he's something I have as a keepsake. Do you have something like that that's a keepsake to you that you hope that you have when you're old, like me? Anybody got something? What do you got?
I got my Allison, and I named it Ellie,
yeah.
And she's way like this.
Aha, she have green eyes?
No, she has sort of like a bluish yellow.
Ah, bluish yellow. Anybody else got something that you hope that you have when you're old like me? What do you have?
I have a teddy bear named Teddy.
His name's Teddy too? Oh my. That's kind of a coincidence, isn't it? Well, now, the reason I have Teddy is because my mom, when I got to the point when I didn't play with him so much, my mom took him and she kept him in a safe place. I had a John Deere tractor with pedals on it that you would run, and my dad took care of that. And so here's the point that I really want to tell you. My mom took care of Teddy and gave him to me when I got old enough to leave home. We don't know where the tractor is, so if you've got something important that you want when you grow up, make sure you leave it with your mom to take care of, okay? All right? So that's the part with Teddy, and you guys can go back and sit with your folks or wherever you came from. And we're going to keep Teddy here for a second. Now, the point about Teddy is that Teddy is something that I have from my childhood that has stayed with me. There's been a lot of times in my life that I forgot that I've got Teddy. But you know, he's always been there, and he probably always will be. My brother had his brother, who didn't do so well. Somebody robbed my brother's house, and they thought that my brother might have put money inside his teddy bear, so they ripped him open. So he's had some pretty serious surgery and some repairs, but he's doing pretty good. So anyway, so I hope things are going good there. My brother, he's doing pretty good too. I'm going to put Teddy right back here, but remember he's here, folks. Remember he's with us today. So the thing with Teddy, you know, my parents and other significant people in my life gave me a lot of things when I was little that I still have with me. And some of them I forget that I have. You know, one of the things that they did is that they taught me all sorts of things that they wanted me to have and be preserved. And they thought when I was old enough, kind of like Teddy and my mom, is that they would turn them over to me and I would keep them and preserve them, just like Teddy. But those things, they're not things at all. They're values, they're practices, they're beliefs, their actions, their behaviors, the things that they taught me that they thought that I should believe and do as I grew older. They're things that were instilled in me when I was young, and they're things that were taught to me over and over again. You see, I was trained. You know how training works, right? Is that you just wire it in so hard that the person doesn't have any choice, that they've got it in them. They call it hard, some people call that hardwiring, these cultural things. And it means that it's just something that becomes so much a part of you because it just gets put in from the time you're young that it just never gets separated. The Bible talks about that when it talks about train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he's old, he'll not depart from it. But sometimes, just like Teddy here, I forget I've got these things. My folks and others, people at school, people at church, they had some things that they wanted me to know and believe, and things they wanted, ways they wanted me to behave. And let me just share a couple with you, two briefly and one a little more, that they trained me. Especially my mom. The thing that she trained was being clean. Can you identify with this? So it's like when you start out in the morning with clean clothes and you're clean and your neck is clean and behind your ears is clean and all of that. So she always, and her way of being clean was by scrubbing. Okay, you know scrubbing? Anybody back there identify with scrubbing? When I was in the first grade, we had this story we learned to read. We were learning to read, and it told this story about this lady who was in Holland, I think, and her children, she scrubbed them so much that she scrubbed the features right off of their faces. And I know where somebody like that lives. I had to tell them. Yep, that was my mom. And I think the training took, my wife tries to like make it a little more stylish, because I don't think my mom taught me much about style, because it was mainly just blue jeans and a cloth shirt and brogans and white socks and all of that, but I think it took. My parents also taught me about waste, and they hated waste. Just don't waste anything. And they had some really good reasons to teach me that. I won't go into the story, but you know, if you don't have a lot, wasting becomes a really big deal, right? There's not going to be enough to go around. Well, it took. And as you can imagine, I mean, I live in a time and a place where sometimes I think people are in a competition to see who can waste the most. It kind of drives me crazy. You know, I think American culture, most families waste more than most of the people in the world have to live on in a typical year. You know, it just rubs me the wrong way. And it's because it's something that was hardwired into me. But then here's the one I want to tell you more about. My parents instilled in me and trained in me to be a diligent worker. My dad was what you might want to call a motivational speaker. Can any of you identify with that? That he had some pretty strongly held views that I think he got from his dad, and my mom did too, about working, is that, you know, that you just want to make sure that you work. Both of them did that. They themselves worked hard pretty much all the time, and they insisted that I did too, even when I was a little guy. When I was a teenager, I remember my dad explaining to me how things worked on the farm. He told me, if I look in your direction and I see you doing something that I know needs to be done, good. If I have to find something for you to do, I will, but you need to know you're probably not going to enjoy it nearly as much. Ooh, I guess he was kind of a motivational speaker, wasn't he? It was a pretty good guidance, and he sort of defined what work really is. It's activity that you do that creates something useful or something valuable. Okay, that's what work is. I think the training worked. You know, And don't, listen, don't think that I'm trying to tell you I'm the most industrious person that you know, because I'm not. I mean, I'm sure there's other people here that are more industrious than I. I look at Russ Dabney, for example, and I think Archie must have been some kind of motivational speaker. He might have been, you know? And I think there's other people that are just really, really industrious. And sometimes, you know, that I try not to be industrious, but I'm just not very good at it. Is that because once, you know, if I get tired and I can rest, that's okay. But if I just try to do nothing, I pretty soon just start getting, you know, it's not good. I mean, I don't feel comfortable not doing anything. And if you want to see me just twitching, stick me in a meeting where people are talking about all the work that needs to be done and why isn't it getting done when I could be out working. It just drives me nuts. I mean, I'm just shaking, so, or chewing my fingernails or something like that. But it makes me uncomfortable not to be working. It just feels like I ought to be doing something, like making something useful, doing something useful. And beyond that, my parents instilled in me this thought that everybody who can work should work. Did any of you get that too? Is any of these out there? If you can work, you should work? Yeah. Well, so where does that go? Not only am I uncomfortable when I'm not working, I am uncomfortable when you're not working. How about that? Well, la-di-da. Who do I think I am, right? Well, let me tell you some more about it, though. There are some reasons why it's important that you work. First of all, what you earn, what you create, is what you and your family can live on. That's pretty important, isn't it? I got six reasons here. Second, do you know in the United States that more than half the population are people who can't work? There are children, something like 30% of the population, elderly people, 20% of the population. There are people who are trying to work, they're unemployed right now, they're looking for work. There are people who are in prison. I mean, there are people who cannot work. There are people who are disabled and cannot work. It's over half of the population. And as more and more of the population can't work, it's more and more important that the people who can work do. And then it comes down to this, is that I think it's unfair that people who choose not to work would expect me, for example, to work to support them. Why would they think that? I mean, that just doesn't make any sense at all. Fourth is that when able people don't work, their tendency is to do things that they shouldn't be doing. Now, the word I wrote down is illicit behavior, but you know what I'm talking about. Is if you don't have to work for a living, you've got time to do all sorts of things that you shouldn't be doing. Committing crimes, harming people. There's all sorts of things that people do. But it's not in the Bible. It doesn't say that idle hands are the devil's workshop, but it does say that when you don't work, you have time to become things like gossips and busybodies. So, the fifth reason is that working's good for you. You know, if you work, it keeps your body working, it keeps your mind working, psychologically, socially, it gives you some outlet. It's good for you. Inactivity leads to problems. Right? When somebody retires, if they just retire and don't do anything, it just messes them up. You know, we've got something in our sound called Goodwill Industries. You know what it's founded on? It's founded on disabled people being able to work, because being able to work makes them feel better about themselves. In the United States, we have something called the American Disabilities Act, which makes it illegal for employers to deny work to people who are disabled if they can do the work. So there's all kinds of things, and they do that because being able to work makes people feel better about themselves. And lastly, I guess I tell you, it's in the Scripture. Listen to this. This is from 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verses 10 and 11. This is Paul talking to the church in Thessalonica. He said, For even when we were with you, we used to give this order: if anyone is not willing to work, then he is not to eat either. For we hear that some among you are leading an undisciplined life, doing no work at all, but acting like busybodies. 1 Thessalonians 4 says, "And make it your ambition to lead a quiet life and attend to your own business and work with your hands, just as we commanded you, so that you will behave properly toward outsiders and not be in any need." 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 8, it says, "But if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever." 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 13, talking about women specifically, it says, "At the same time, they learn to be idle as they go around from house to house, not merely idle, but also gossips and busybodies, talking about things not proper to mention." Now he's talking about that they should work. Yet I just get all riled up when I see people that my generation would have called bums. I think younger generation calls them slackers. Is that the right word? Slackers. You know, people who spend more energy avoiding work than they do working. Now, why did I tell you all of this? Well, I hope by now that you can see that this is something that, it's like Teddy here, it's something that's from my childhood that I still have, whether I remember it or not. This is something that's more ingrained in me than just some little thing. This is something that somebody spent time working to make sure how I feel about this and what my beliefs are and what my actions are would be as they are. Do you have anything like Teddy? Did your parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles and school teachers and Sunday school teachers spend a lot of time on you, absolutely ingraining something in you so that you feel really strong about it? Strong enough that if somebody was violating what they taught you, that you would feel offended by it? Are there any yeses out there? Are there any heads nodding? There's a couple. Okay. So there are things like this that we've got that they come to us from childhood, and how can I say this? This is an example that I gave you that's about me, but if you think about the way our system works, think about schools for a minute. What are schools invented for? You know what a school of fish does? They all swim together. Schools are about swimming together. It's about believing the same things and behaving in the same way. Why do you think all of you are sitting here still and listening to one guy talk? Do you think that's natural for you? It's probably not. It's something that you learned because you were schooled. You were trained to do that. It teaches us things about nationalism and patriotism and what is social justice and what are proper role models. And it teaches us to respect authority, that there are all sorts of things that schooling schools you to do. It teaches things that, you know, it used to be that the school that's over here, they call you and I, you know, it used to have a different name. It was called the Iowa Normal School. That was a long time ago. And the reason they called it the Normal School was because the people that ran that school were training people who would train children, and they were training them in what they believed to be normal. That if you didn't believe like that, you weren't normal. Ooh, think about that for a second. What's the purpose? So they teach about past leaders of the country, and they immortalize them and tell myths about them and things that they did, make them bigger than life, bigger than they really were, so that you'll respect the leaders you have today. They tell the legends of past heroes so that the children of today would want to become the heroes of tomorrow. They teach all sorts of things. For Western civilization, for European culture, whatever you want to call it, this system has worked really well. I mean, I'm not knocking it. Obviously, it works. There's a reason why, and I think the reason is this training of our young all to act and believe as one and believe the same things, whether they're right or not, so that they all work in unison. There's a reason why the countries that educate their children in this way we own practically all of the wealth on the earth. There's a reason why. It works. But here's the point. All of that is the culture that we came up in. It's not from God. God didn't tell them to do that. It's the culture. It's stressing the things that are important to that culture. And sometimes the things that they stress are not what's best for people. Sometimes it's not best for anybody, even the people who are being trained or the people that they affect. And part of the training is this whole business of that you should conform. That everybody should conform to the same normal. What happens if you're in school and you don't conform to what's normal? I think the word is ostracize, that you become ostracized. Well, ostracized, that means that the teachers ridicule you, that your classmates harass you for being different, or maybe they even bully you. That if you're different, a school is going to take the one that's not swimming with the rest of the school, and it's going to punish them by disapproval. Disapproval. And disapproval, when you take it in its strongest form, there's a word for that, isn't there? It's contempt. There's another word, it's despise. That the system and something that's ingrained in all of us, and sometimes I forget that I've got that in me. I got pretty carefully trained for that. I was trained from the culture that I came up with, that if somebody's not behaving in the way that seems like normal to me, that it's okay to despise them, to hold them in contempt. Sometimes I forget, like old Teddy here, that I've got that in me. Have you got that in you? Did you come from the same place that I did? That you were trained that everybody's got to really think and be the same? Believe the same things that you do? I'll bet some of you do. Maybe not everybody, but I'll bet some do. And in my particular example, the Bible does explicitly say that everyone who can work should work. But I believe that way further than what I've got any justification in the Bible, don't I? You know I'm guilty. The Bible also teaches just as explicitly that it's not right to hold other people in contempt. When Jesus was teaching, that very frequently he had a run-in with a group of people that we know of as Pharisees. You remember the Pharisees? They were the guys who were taught and trained to do what was right according to their set of rules. And the Pharisees consistently held other people in contempt or despised other people. And more than any other group that Jesus really went after, who corrected, he corrected, were these Pharisees. There is a story that is in Luke chapter 8, and I think we remember the parable, but look at the beginning verse of the story. It's in Luke chapter 18, verse 9. It says, "And he also told this parable to some people who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and viewed others with contempt. He said, 2 men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and was praying to himself, 'God, I thank you that I am not like other people. Swindlers, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax gatherer. I fast twice a week. I pay tithes of all I get. But the tax collector, standing a distance away, was unwilling even to lift up his eyes to heaven, but was beating his breast and saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you that this man went up to his house rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but he who humbles himself will be exalted.'" It isn't the only passage where Jesus did this. Luke chapter 7, there's a story about him going to the house of a Pharisee named Simon. And there was a woman who, it said, was a sinful woman who came and was washing his feet. If you pick the story up in chapter 7, down in verse 39, it has Simon saying to himself, it said, "If this man were a prophet, he would would know what sort of person this woman is who is touching him, and that she's the sinner. Do you think Simon held her in contempt? Yeah, he did. So, and Jesus told him a parable about two debtors and one owed more. And he asked him, he said, Simon, who do you think loved him more? And he said, I guess the one that you forgave more. Yeah. The story of the prodigal son. It's in Luke chapter 15. And it begins before the story of the prodigal son in chapter 15, verse 1. Here's the beginning of it. It's what prompted the story. It says, now all the tax collectors and sinners were coming near him to listen to him. Both the Pharisees and the scribes began to grumble, saying, this man receives sinners and eats with them. They despised these people. They thought less of Jesus because he was associating with him. And he told them the story of the prodigal son. The son who came back, and the brother who was indignant that his brother was forgiven. In Luke chapter 16 and verse 15, he said this to the same group of people, you are those who justify yourselves in the sight of men, but God knows your hearts. For that which is highly esteemed among men is detestable in the sight of God. And if you want to see the admonitions toward the church, I won't read it here today, but go back and read Romans chapter 14, where it talks about this business of accepting people rather than accepting them so you can tell them why their opinions are wrong. You see, just like Teddy here, all of us have got something that's built into us from the time we're young. And that's something that's built into us is this idea that we can influence people to be better by holding them in contempt. That somehow showing I'm right and you're wrong and I hold you in contempt is going to cause somebody to be a better person. And it just doesn't work. Now, I'm not saying that your opinions are wrong and that the things that your parents and your grandparents and aunts and uncles and school teachers and Sunday school teachers taught you about ways that you should behave are wrong. I'm not saying that at all. But I think it's important to know the difference between what is our opinion and what are God's command. You're probably better off if you live by the things that you were taught when you were young. You're probably better off. And it may be that some of them are based on things that you can find in the Bible. And you probably know somebody that if they lived by the same rules you were taught to live by would be a lot better off too. I think everybody here knows somebody like that. But what is wrong is holding them in contempt. It violates what Jesus taught. And even if that doesn't mean anything to you, this part should. It doesn't work. You don't influence people to do what's right and do better by holding them in contempt. Have you ever heard somebody say, and let me read this so I get it right. Have you ever heard somebody say that we should do things that are right so that we could hold ourselves up as an example to others? Have you ever heard that? That we should do what's right so that we could hold ourselves up as an example to others. This is a corruption of what Jesus taught in Matthew chapter 5, verse 14. He did say that we are the light of the world. He did say that. But verse 16, if you read down a couple verses, it doesn't say, let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify you. It doesn't say that. It says, let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Not you, Him, God. When we look down on others and hold ourselves up as an example, the only people who are impressed by that are other people that feel the same way. It's fact. people who are being looked down on are not inspired to do better by this. They walk away thinking to themselves, I may not be right, but at least I'm not like that self-righteous hypocrite. That's what they think. And just by the way, none of us are perfect. Somebody that feels that way, they may come up with a list of other failings of us. If I say that to somebody, he may discover that I've got other faults too. And they might even be willing to share them with other people that would like to listen. Have you ever heard that? That so-and-so, he's down at that church and he did this and this and this and this. So, and it started with this. This look at me attitude, it doesn't draw people toward us. It pushes people away from the church. Let me say that again. This look at me attitude, it doesn't pull people toward us. It pushes people away from the church. In droves. It hurts a lot of churches. You know, Jesus showed an attitude, and where's Jay? I think Jay called and he asked you, what are you going to talk about? And I told him, and I think especially with that last song, you picked up on the thought, does Jesus care? You know, Jesus had an attitude and behavior toward other people that worked to change their life. He was the greatest man who ever lived. And he humbled himself and he acted as if he was absolutely the lowest. He changed their lives because he did that. He cared more about the person than he did letting the person know how right he was and how wrong the person was. He showed them compassion instead of contempt. We should not do what's right to exalt ourselves before others. You know, righteousness isn't a burden. It's not something that we must do to gain our salvation or to show other people that we're right or give a gift to God. Righteousness, we should do what's right because God took the trouble to tell us what right is. We should do what's right because we're obedient to God. We should do right because it's our gift from God. We should do right because God made us for that purpose, to do good works. We should do right because it glorifies God. We should do what's right. And if we do what's right for those reasons, for the right reasons, we will be the light of the world. Now, I'm not telling you this to convict this church or criticize somebody for saying this here. You know, the thing Sharon heard, she heard somewhere else. But I wonder how often we stop and think about this, our relationship to other people and contempt. And if it's going to be different in the church, if it's going to be better in the church, it has to start with us here. So here is the question that I would ask you today. Are you shining God's light in the world today? If you haven't accepted the gift of redemption from God, you know the church is the bride of Christ, and the church and the elders are here to help you start walking down that path of light. That's what we're here for on Sunday mornings and other times. And we're here, and we hope that you come and do that. If you have stumbled in your walk, maybe not in this way, but in some other way, and you need the help of the church to get back on the path, the church is here for that too. And finally, if the burdens of life are wearing you down, and all of us have burdens from time to time, and you just need the help of the church to stand back up in your time, this is the time that we call for you to come and join us and come call on the church. The bride and spirit are waiting for you.